Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for joining us as we kick off another week of Cresta in the Afternoon. Much of this week we'll be in Grand Rapids, Michigan at the annual Acton University. So I look forward to talking to you throughout the week from Grand Rapids. Today, however, we're going to lead off talking about an incident in the popular American politics, which is becoming more and more polarizing and vindictive. Our friend Raymond Ibrahim, who has been on this program many times talking about issues related to Islam, has been dropped from a U.S. Army War College talk that he was to give because of a massive smear campaign by the Council on American Islamic Relations. Now, remember, the CAIR, C-A-I-R, is an unindicted co-conspirator, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, in the largest terrorist funding case in American history, and has been designated as a terrorist organization for U.S. allies, such as the United Arab Emirates. So we're going to talk with Raymond about this attack on his good name. We're also going to be spending time with John and Claire Grabowski about family spirituality. Again, this is one of those areas that's really being developed right now. I think it grows out of the Second Vatican Council's emphasis on the universal call to holiness and the recognition that marriage is a vocation as well. We're going to talk with John and Claire. Also, Senator Tom Cotton of Arizona joins us, looking at Arlington National Cemetery and the military funerals that are there, the precision with which they're conducted in the symbology. And with us also would be Jeanette Flood, looking at eight ways of loving God. But first, we'll go to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, June 17th. It's the Feast of St. Albert Chmielowski. Today's news is sponsored by Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The father involved in the viral confrontation with Phoenix police says he believed cops were going to execute him.
I haven't been able to sleep at night. I stay up all night, and it just keeps flashing back. The gun, a barrel being pointed at my face, I just keep getting that same image over and over and over.
Cell phone video shows officers pointing guns and yelling threats at Drayvon Ames, his pregnant fiancée Aisha Harper, and their two young daughters after the family said their daughter took a doll from a Family Dollar store. Hip-hop artist Jay-Z's company, Roc Nation, is providing legal support for the family as they expect to file a $10 million lawsuit. There was a police shooting in Dallas today. A man is dead after an exchange of gunfire with police outside a federal building downtown. The FBI has identified the man as 22-year-old Brian Clyde, and they don't believe he was working with anyone. The Supreme Court is tossing out lower court rulings against bakers in an Oregon same-sex cake dispute. NBC News legal analyst Pete Williams says the high court ordered another round of hearings in state courts.
With instructions to reconsider in light of its decision 2 years ago in a case involving almost the same set of facts and a Colorado baker.
Bakers Melissa and Aaron Klein paid a $135,000 judgment to a same-sex couple for declining to create a custom wedding cake for them in 2013. The couple that runs the bakery cited religious concerns. Today is the 25th anniversary of the infamous slow-speed car chase after the murders of O.J. Simpson's ex-wife and her friend Ronald Goldman. O.J. Simpson hid in the back seat of a white Ford Bronco that led police along Southern California's freeways. Simpson was arrested at his home and later acquitted in the so-called Trial of the Century in 1995. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. More and more, we're seeing a trend develop of disinviting speakers on controversial subjects. This has been on the rise in American universities in particular in recent years. But we have a situation today that appears to be the first time that a speaker at a U.S. military educational institution has been subject to such a smear campaign. With me right now is Raymond Ibrahim, who was a widely published author, public speaker, an expert in the area of Islam and the Middle East. His books include Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, and The Al-Qaeda Reader. He has provided expert testimony for Islam-related lawsuits. He's testified before Congress regarding the conceptual failures that dominate American discourse concerning Islam and the worsening plight of Egypt's Christian Copts. He was born and raised in the U.S. by Coptic Egyptian parents who themselves were born and raised in the Middle East. Is fluent in English and Arabic, and you can follow him at RaymondIbrahim.com. Raymond, it's good to have you back here again.
Hi, Al. Good to be with you again.
What the heck is happening here?
Well, the story is the United States Army War College, probably the most prestigious military academic institution in Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, invited me back in January to come give a talk on June 19th, this coming Wednesday, 2 days from now. You know, in their invitation, both by phone and email, they're very enthusiastic to have me. In fact, they were upset that I had to settle for June 19th because they didn't think they'd get enough, as many people as they'd like. They wanted it to be, as you know, as many Army military personnel. These lectures are geared to faculty, staff, instructors, and students at the War College. At any rate, I accepted, and it was set, and that was the end of it. And then on May 28th, the Council on Islamic Relations, on Islamic-American Relations, CARE, which, of course, has terrorist links with Hamas and all that, wrote a very formal letter to the heads of the Army War College, basically, you know, to saying the great disappointments of the Muslim community of Harrisburg, which is right next to them, which has 12 mosques, and there's so many Muslims. If you actually look at the letter, it's almost like a threat. But anyway, and they were calling on the college to cancel my talk, which was about my last book that you mentioned, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. So it was a historical lecture that I was giving. And in their letter, they said, you know, that my writings and my book especially is flawed, et cetera, et cetera. Never once, of course, did they cite a single sentence in the 352-page book to show what I was saying wrong. At any rate, after that letter came out and was reported in the media, the War College made it a point to call me and tell me, you know what, we're not even responding to them. We're not capitulating. You're on. And that was good. The very next day, CARE sent out a very hysterical-sounding press release, and also a group known as Empower, which is Linda Sarsour's group, sent out a very hysterical petition, basically calling me, who is of Egyptian Middle Eastern descent, a racist, quote, and a white nationalist, who if allowed, I'm not kidding, you know, who if allowed to speak about history, Islamic history with the West, in front of a war college, would incite an already racist military to start killing Muslims in the streets of America. Now, that is not a joke. That was essentially, and I can pull it up and read it to you, you know, that particular excerpt. But they sent that out, and they called on Muslims everywhere to protest, et cetera, et cetera. And then soon thereafter, it got canceled. So the War College contacted me, but they're not admitting it's a cancellation. They keep telling me, well, we're postponing it. And they're telling the media that the postponement has absolutely nothing to do with CARE or this, that they just decided, you know, 2-3 days after the smear campaign and 6 months after they scheduled it and just 9 days before the event to postpone it. So it's a capitulation, and they're trying to cover up for it. And that's just basically, you know, the story in a nutshell.
Well, if it's a cancellation, I mean, if it's a postponement rather than a cancellation, did they propose future dates?
No, basically what they're trying to say is they want me to believe it's a postponement and agree, and then everything gets hushed up.
Right.
And then months later, when I try to reschedule, they're going to probably put up all sorts of obstacles, and the whole thing will be forgotten, and that's the end of that.
That's right.
That's what's really happening. And so, yeah, it's just a complete capitulation. And the point here, which I think everyone needs to pay attention to, I mean, you earlier said that, you know, it's a trend, disinvited speakers. But now it's gotten to the point, I mean, look at the two most disturbing facts, in my opinion, are this. That a guy of Egyptian Arab heritage, me, who's fluent in Arabic, whose mom and dad come from the Middle East, you know, my siblings were born in Egypt. Yep. I'm the only one that was born here. That they're characterizing me as a racist and a white nationalist, okay? Wow. And that of all people, or actually of all institutions to buckle, it's the War College, not some liberal university, okay? So, you know, if it's gotten to the point where the accusations are so patently false, and yet even the one institution that you would expect would be in the fight for free speech is also capitulating, it's really hard to imagine whoever is ever going to be able to talk or hear about Islam again, the truth.
This is infuriating. That terrible precedent for the U.S. Army War College. Let's just look at this a little bit. The history of Islam, by any scholar's recognition, is a history of conquest and warfare, and it's been tied to theological concerns within Islam. And this can't be ignored, and yet somebody like yourself, who's looked at the history and is comfortable laying this out, is refused a place at the table to point this out.
Yeah.
This is a denial. I mean, this becomes a denial of fact.
Yep. And you see, you know, I mean, let me just read you a very quick excerpt of what was written and what compelled them. Okay, so this is from that Linda Sarsour petition. She wrote, quote, "Just a few days ago, California Representative Duncan Hunter, who ran an explicitly Islamophobic campaign for Congress, casually admitted that he and his unit killed probably hundreds of civilians, probably killed women and children in Iraq. The very next sentence, which is underlined, says, tell the U.S. Army War College, Ibrahim's book lecture would push the same kind of incendiary Islamophobic rhetoric that has led to violence inflicted on Muslim communities, both in the U.S. and abroad. In other words, if I get up and talk about history, soldiers are going to go out and start killing Muslims in the streets. And, you know, you were earlier saying that, you know, the history of Islam is well known. You know, you say that because you know it, but, you know, sadly, it's not well known, especially amongst the younger generation.
Yeah, that's a good point.
This is what this is about. It's trying to really suppress the reality of this history. You know, future generations who will become future leaders are absolutely clueless. And that's sort of where we're already at right now. You know, it's only well-learned older generations like me and you who kind of understand this right now.
Right.
But other people are just left in the dark.
You know, let's talk a little bit about CARE while we're at this. CARE is an unindicted co-conspirator, right, in one of the largest terrorist funding cases in American history. Tell me about that.
Sure. So let me actually pull it up because I can give you the exact quote. Because this is from the U.S. attorney. It's a letter from the U.S. attorney that was written sometime in 2000 from the U.S. Department of Justice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, the attorney general requesting information regarding the evidence and findings by the Department of Justice and the FBI, which resulted in the Council on American Islamic Relations being named as an unindicted co-conspirator of the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development in the United States. The Holy Land case, it wasn't one of the largest terrorists. It was the largest case. And it was essentially all about funneling funds through CARE to Hamas, which, of course, is a U.S.-designated terrorist organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's only on the tip of the iceberg, because there's so much. I can read on and on about, you know, CARE, what CARE has done, and all the there's a whole article out there. I can even send it to you if you'd like to link to it. It's from the the Center of Security Policy.
Sure.
And they have a whole bullet list of tons and tons of, you know, this individual of CARE indicted for terrorist charges, that individual. And usually CARE, after that person is busted, they say, oh, we didn't know, we have nothing to do with him, we fired him, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but it's a constant thing that's just constantly going on with CARE. And look, think about this, okay? The United Arab Emirates, an Arab nation, which is actually, of course, ally, you know, U.S. ally, mm-hmm. had CARE by name designated. It's a designated terrorist organization.
Wow.
Okay. And so lots of other Muslim countries and Arab countries have the Muslim Brotherhood designated as a terrorist group. But because CARE is a front of the Muslim Brotherhood, the UAE has labeled them as well by name CARE as a designated terrorist group.
Wow.
You know? I mean, so that's all that is so telling.
You've been working on this for a long time. I remember I first saw your name when I began looking through the Al Qaeda Reader many years ago now. Are we any better off as a nation? It looks as though that cliche, Islam is a religion of peace, is as lodged in the American imagination today as it was back in 2001.
Exactly, and that's because of this massive campaign against free speech. If people can't get the facts, okay? So, my talk was about a book about history, mind you. I'm not
right.
Military history. I wasn't going to get up and talk about the contemporary Islamist infiltration of U.S. institutions, at which point I can understand why CARE would worry. It was a military history, but, you know, I actually give them credit, and we can get into that the first time, why they understand the danger of the history. But it's a military history, it's 352 pages, and it's got about 1,000 end notes, most of them to primary sources. And so they can't pull out and say how it's wrong.
Right.
And yet this military history, what it shows you is that for literally over a millennium, Islam, in all its manifestations, whether it's original Arab manifestation, it's Berber manifestation, Turkic manifestation, Tatar or Mongolian manifestation, all of those attacks that were on Europe from all its corners, reaching as far as Iceland and attacking America before it could even elect its first president, the Barbary Wars, all of those attacks were articulated by the attackers as jihad.
Right.
They were all quoting the Quran. They were essentially, in short, doing and saying what the Islamic State or ISIS does and says, which we're told has nothing to do with Islam. So that's, I think, what they're trying to cover up. When you find out that actually what ISIS says and does has been going on for a millennium, then ISIS is not an aberration.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you what. Tell people how they can get a hold of you, Raymond.
Best place is my website, RaymondIbrahim.com. There's a contact. And you can just fill out a form. And also a link to my book, including the one in question that CARE doesn't want anyone to read, is there, Sword and Scimitar.
Okay. Raymond, we'll talk again soon. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks, Al.
Your worldview governs most everything else about your moral choices, your assumptions, and attitudes. It's the main premise behind your belief system. Worldview is the ethical air you breathe, or if you are a fish, the water you swim in. Think of how different the atheistic worldview is from the theistic one. If you believe there's no God and you're just electric meat with an extra bit of charm, there's no special plan for your life, and certainly no life after death, that's going to affect your daily decisions right down to your attitude to the alarm clock in the morning. If you're a Christian, then you're going to see everything in a very different way. Most people cobble together their worldview from the news, their friends, pop culture, maybe their school textbooks. What's your worldview? Can you sum it up in one sentence? Because it determines everything else. This is Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I often go back to my childhood. In church, we love to be reverent, to Christ present in the Eucharist, to Christ on the cross. But I was also impressed by the reverence of my friends in the Salvation Army. They had a little band. And I used to walk past the band on Sunday morning on my way to church. And I was just a child. But I said, you know, they're trying to pray to God. They're showing reverence to God. All this was reverence. Now what do I see? I hear one irreverence after another. And week after week, month after month, the media churns out things that make fun of religion in general and make fun of Christianity in particular, and particularly make fun of the Catholic Church. No class. Absolutely no class.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
I would always hear from different people at non-Catholic churches that Catholics were going to hell, or that they really didn't know who the Lord was. The Catholic Church is not all what people say it is. I mean, it's completely different. There's so many stereotypes. It's very possible to know the Lord, and it's very possible to have a relationship with God in the Catholic Church. I believe I was born into the Catholic Church, and that's where I belong.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Have you heard about Lord Teach Me to Pray? Lord Teach Me to Pray is a prayer series based upon the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Training retreats will be held this summer and fall in various parts of the country. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com to find a training retreat near you. In this exciting time of the new evangelization, the best way we can share the faith is by strengthening our own relationship with the Lord Jesus.
Lord Teach Me to Pray is sure to be transformative.
Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com and click on Facilitator Training Retreats.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tomeo, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
It's practically an epidemic. 20% of Americans suffer from anxiety disorders, and millions more wrestle with worry and stress on a daily basis. For us as Christians, all that worry gets mixed up with a lot of guilt. How can we stop worrying and start living an anxiety-free life? I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, and in my new book, Unworried, A Life Without Anxiety, you'll learn how to respect how God made us and build new habits of thinking, communicating, and acting that will help set you free from worry. You can get your copy of Unworried and any of my other books at AveMariaRadio.net.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. It seems to me that one of the great areas of development in Catholic spirituality has to do with the broad area of lay spirituality, but in particular, family spirituality. And what is the relationship between the health of the parish and the health of the domestic church? And we're going to continue talking about these things. As you know, Dr. Gregory Popchak and I talk about this frequently, but there are many people who are trying to think clearly about what this emphasis on family and marriage spirituality is all about. And two people who have been doing great work in this area are John and Claire Grabowski, been married for 33 years, five children, three grandchildren. They've been doing parish work for a long time, pre-Cana marriage ministry, also post-Cana ministry. And together, they're the authors of a commentary on the anniversary edition of Familiaris Consortio that was published in 2015. And we've talked with them about their curriculum, One Body, a program for marriage formation for the new evangelization. John's taught moral theology at the Catholic University of America for the last 27 years. And Claire has been a Catholic educator, a stay-at-home mom, a financial administrative assistant, and companion to the elderly. And it's great to have both of you back with me. Thanks.
Great to
Thank
be with you,
Al.
Thank
you, Al, for having us.
This is such an important area, it seems to me. And, John, let me ask you, does it seem to you, as somebody who's very much involved in this whole field of marriage and family spirituality, does it look as though we're experiencing a change within at least American Catholicism about the relationship between the domestic church and the parish?
Great question, Al. I think so. I think we're realizing, especially as kind of the imprint of Christianity kind of recedes from our public life more and more, mm-hmm. that we really have to be more intentional as parents building and forming Christian community within our families, within our households. We don't have a lot of the cultural and social support that we used to in forming our children. A lot of people don't live near their families. They don't have the support of extended family networks around them to help them. So we need a deeper and more intentional approach to parenthood, and certainly a deeper engagement in the life of the parish can really support that and support the domestic church, as you say.
Do you find that parish priests are aware of this problem?
Not as much as they need to be.
Okay. Yeah.
When I teach seminarians and when I teach, have the opportunity to train priests, this is something I really try to drive home to them, the need to better and more deeply engage families and married couples in the life of the parish, and to look for more and new opportunities to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Claire, talk to me a little bit about, when we talk about the family as domestic church, what does that translate into practically in the, you know, organization maintenance of the home?
Oh, that's a really good question, too. I think it means that it's our responsibility as the parents of the family to remember that we are a family that God created to help each other get to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that means we need to create opportunities for our children and our spouses to encounter the Lord daily. And this means praying together, learning to ask forgiveness of each other, most importantly, learning to receive the graces from the sacraments. So introducing our children to the great grace that comes through the sacrament of their baptism and the sacrament of the daily mass where we receive Jesus in the Eucharist, teaching them to go to confession and repenting to each other and to the family so that going to confession isn't that hard of a thing because they're already used to asking for forgiveness.
Yes, yes.
So these are just a few of the ways, but even including, you know, making the family dinner a priority so that you can talk about what God is doing in their lives or the struggles in the culture that are happening around us. This is our responsibility to really help form them to see God's vision for the family and the church.
I remember years ago when I was an evangelical pastor, there was a great bias among those who were members of the church that I pastored, a great bias, positive bias, towards naming, giving children biblical names.
Hmm.
What's the significance of naming the child?
Well, I'll take a first go at that. Claire may want to jump in and add. But, I mean, names in Scripture, of course, give an insight into the essence and the nature of the person, which is why it's so important that God reveals his name to the people of Israel, mm-hmm. and then God further reveals his name to us in sending Jesus, his son, in the incarnation. We celebrated Trinity Sunday yesterday.
Yep.
So when God discloses himself through his name, we come to understand who he is more deeply. So very often in Scripture, when God calls someone, he will change their name, signifying that they've received a new identity and a new mission that God calls them to accomplish. So as parents, we have this incredible privilege of being able to choose a name for our child. Pope Francis says that's the name by which God will address our child for all eternity.
Wow.
Think about that. So choosing a name from Scripture, choosing a name from a saint is a way to make our children aware that they have a mission, they have an identity, they have a call from the Lord. And then in confirmation, or when they enter religious life, they get to choose another name. And maybe in choosing the name of another saint, develop a new relationship with another heavenly patron to guide them as adult Christians.
Sure, sure. Claire, you want to add anything?
Well, I guess I'll just add one of the names of our children, because I think it really shows what John is trying to say here. We had our first four kids in 7 years, and then we have a six-year gap before God gave us our youngest. So when we were pregnant with Abby, we had a sonogram where the kids all came and got to see their new baby sister. Mm-hmm. And then we went home and we really talked together and prayed what we were going to name her. And we found the name Abigail in the Bible, and we decided that since it meant the Father rejoices, mm-hmm. that we knew God was rejoicing that we were having another child.
Yes.
And her middle name is Grace because it means gift.
Yes.
And, you know, we try to tell Abby all the time, you are Abigail Grace. God rejoiced that you were joining our family, and the gift of his grace is in you. And, you know, it's just really, I think, even though she doesn't love her name right now, I think as she gets older, she'll really appreciate the meaning of it. And John and I love it because it reminds us of the blessing that she is to us.
Amen. No, that is interesting. Do the kids love the name? Well, that's kind of secondary to its importance because they'll grow into it. That's the hope, right? We talk about, I think many Catholics, when they hear of vocation, they tend to think of the sacrament of holy orders and those who are called to the ministerial priesthood or those who are called to religious life. And I still think we're catching up on the idea that marriage is a vocation and there is a call. Are we making progress on this?
Well, I think it's, again, another good question, Al. I think there's an even prior understanding that we need to help people develop, and that is even prior to a call to a particular state in life, every one of us as baptized Christians has a vocation to holiness.
Right, right.
So sometimes Claire and I give talks together and we meet young people who have been told by a priest or by the college they attended that they don't have a vocation until they enter religious life or maybe marriage secondarily.
Yeah.
And we try to tell them, no, that's not true. Every Christian is called to holiness. Scripture tells us that. The tradition of the church tells us that. So first and foremost, that's our basic vocation.
Yeah.
And then when we're formed in that vocation, and especially as we develop a prayer life and the ability to hear God's voice and discern, then we're in a position to hear God call us to a further state in life, religious life, priesthood, marriage. So I think we are making progress, seeing marriage as a vocation, but I think it would be easier to make that progress if we realized, first and foremost, that every Christian already has a vocation long before a call to a state in life.
If people pick up on the idea that they are called to be saints, they are called to holiness, they are called to be conformed to Christ, that does then go a long way towards being able to appreciate a more specific call to ministerial priesthood, religious life, or to marriage. It still seems to me in many cases that marriage is kind of the default in the imagination of people, right? If I'm not called to religious life or I'm not called to priesthood, then the default is marriage. What do we do to help remedy that distortion?
Go ahead, Claire.
Well, I got the privilege of spending this past 5 days with as a mentor for the Given Institute here in Washington, D.C. And I have to tell you, Al, this was like the best conference I've ever been in. And I've been going to conferences since I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
But it was the Given Forum for young Catholic women leaders. It was a leadership forum. And what I discovered was so each group had a mentor that was a religious sister and a lay woman. And it was really beautiful because these women saw that we all had a vocation. Like John said, it's holiness. But God will use that in different ways. And the religious were so full of joy. And the girls had never seen so many sisters who just had
fun lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were a lot of single women there who were the same age as me, who the Lord didn't lead them to be a religious,
right?
But also didn't lead them to be married.
Yeah, interesting. Hold it there if you would, Claire. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. My guests, John and Claire Grabowski, raising Catholic kids for their vocations.
The EWTN home video highlight for May is the story of Father John Sullivan. A Protestant born into a life of privilege, he left everything to follow God's call to become a Catholic priest and serve the poor and afflicted. And the faithful were blessed with countless miracles. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or call 1-800-854-6316.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Now, on the Ave Maria Radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic Adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks under the prayer section on the Ave Maria Radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
why
a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
the Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
We recently won an important case in federal court in Toledo, Ohio. For too long, city police officers were enforcing local and state laws to prohibit pro-lifers from engaging in free speech activity on the public sidewalks outside of a local abortion center. In our case, the court issued an order prohibiting the city and its police officers from enforcing any local or state law as applied to the expressive activity of pro-life demonstrators, including our clients. This is yet another victory for the First Amendment in a case where a city and its police officers were abusing their authority to silence peaceful pro-life demonstrators to appease those engaged in the baby-killing business. As the court's order demonstrates, the Constitution protects our clients' pro-life activity from such abuse. The government has no authority to silence our clients' speech simply because they are preaching the gospel on a public sidewalk next to an abortion center. Indeed, this victory is yet another blow to the abortion industry, which has too often relied on the government to promote and support its bloody business by silencing those who oppose it. The actions of the city of Toledo and its officers in this case were deplorable, and they violated our clients' fundamental rights. We stop this egregious activity in Toledo, and we intend to stop it wherever it raises its ugly head. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. John and Claire Grabowski. Together, they are authors, most recently, of Raising Catholic Kids for Their Vocations. It's part of our ongoing look at what family spirituality is, marriage spirituality, as an example, as an offshoot of, quote, lay spirituality. And before the break, Claire was talking to us about this recent conference she attended the Given Conference, and was about. So this was about vocations then, is that right, Claire?
No, it was actually about helping form adult women to be leaders.
Leadership, that's right, that's what you said.
In the secular world.
Right.
And what was beautiful about it was that it was led by religious sisters, it was led by married women, and it was led by single women who were living out their vocation in the secular or Catholic world, but we were all desiring to serve the church and to bring people to heaven,
yeah.
Bring people to holiness.
Were I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. No, you go ahead, Al.
Yeah, so the single women who were teaching there, Archbishop Carlson down in St. Louis used to stress this when he was up here in Saginaw, Michigan. And that is the idea that there is a vocation to be single for the Lord, in which one is not necessarily associated with a religious order. Were these women who were single, did they have a vocation to singleness apart from a religious community?
Some of them did, and I'm actually going to let John answer this because he actually is on the board of the Given Forum.
Okay, good.
And he can share with you some of the speakers and some of the people that are involved in it.
Sure.
So, as Claire said, yeah, some of them are intentionally single for the Lord, Al. Some of them are single because that happens to be their current life circumstance.
Right.
They're open to God calling them to marriage or even to religious life.
Mm-hmm.
But what came through, I attended just a little bit of the conference, but what really came through to me in what I heard and the young women there that I interacted with was that to see that they're not, their life isn't on hold.
Right.
In other words, until they enter into marriage or religious life, mm-hmm. that they are called to live an intentional, full Christian life now, and do the next thing that the Lord calls them to now. And again, this is going back to that most basic vocation that we all have, and that is the vocation to holiness. That just then gets specified and kind of re-described when we enter into a state in life, but it doesn't go away. So I really think that if we have a livelier sense of that most basic vocation, I mean, one of the theological problems we have is what's the status of single Christians,
right.
single adult
right.
Christians in the church? Because if the married vocation is often seen as secondary or kind of the default, as you were saying, the single life is just invisible,
right?
Right.
Right.
But if we recognize that no, they're united to Christ in baptism, they're called to live a life of holiness. They're given a mission by God to live now.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's what they're called to do. They're not just waiting for God to lead them into a religious community or into marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that awareness helps relieve the problem of seeing either marriage as a second class
right.
call to holiness and seeing the single state as just kind of an invisible afterthought.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question that I'm sure crosses everybody's mind at one time or other, and that is, how do I discern a vocation, let's say to marriage in particular here, rather than marriage as a default, right?
Right.
How do I say I am called to marry? And then there's often a question that comes up, and that is there a particular one particular soulmate that I'm called to? If I miss this one, I miss the big fish.
Great question. And again, let me have a go at it, and then invite Claire to add.
Sure.
I think that the prior issue is not how do you discern whether you're called to marriage. The prior thing, and this is what we really try to focus on in the book, is how do we learn to hear the Lord?
Yes.
How do we learn to develop a prayer life in which we train our spiritual ears so that we can hear the Lord speak to us, so that we can hear the Lord's call for our lives, and then say yes. And as parents, we're called to help mentor our children to develop that same capacity so that when they, and we've lived through this with some of our adult kids who are now married, you know, when they're trying to say, Lord, what do you want for my life? They already have a relationship with the Lord. They already have a prayer life, so that then the question becomes, well, how do you know when God's speaking to you, which is the question of discernment.
And right.
I mean, Claire and I, maybe Claire can say a little bit more about this. We've learned we discern very differently, but if we both really listen in the way that we do, we get to the same place together. And we've shared that with our kids. To your second question, the soulmate.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most dangerous myths that's out there in our culture, right? That there's only one person who you're meant to marry and be happy with. And if you don't find him, you can never be happy. You can never be fulfilled. In point of fact, J.R.R. Tolkien has a wonderful letter to his son, Michael, in which he says, on a human level, most marriages are a mistake, because even within the church, because probably out there somewhere, there's someone who's better suited, a better match. And yet, once you enter into that marriage with the other person, now this is your soulmate. This is the person God called you to, and God gives you the grace to have a happy, flourishing marriage, even when you live through suffering. So the idea that the reason why the soulmate myth is so dangerous is because couples who marry with that understanding and then start to go through hard times, because every marriage does, suddenly they think, oh, this isn't my soulmate.
Right.
I've got to
get
out and keep looking. And it feeds our culture of divorce.
Yes,
sadly.
It gives extravagant expectations. It generates extravagant expectations
for
what you can expect from your spouse.
Your spouse isn't called to deliver heaven on earth. your spouse is called to call you to holiness.
Right.
One of our good friends loves to say, to paraphrase, he says, as Jesus says in the Gospels, take up your spouse and follow me. Learning to love your spouse is, it's hard.
Yes.
And it's how you grow in holiness.
Indeed. Claire, you want to follow that?
Well, I guess I just would like to share what John said about how we discern differently. John and I met very young. We were freshmen back then, the University of Steubenville.
Mm-hmm.
And we both developed strong relationships with the Lord and strong prayer lives by the witness of our teachers there and the priests there. And we discovered over the years that while John and I pray so differently and discern so differently, God usually tells us the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
John is he's a more type A person, where he likes Ignatian discernment.
Mm-hmm.
So he likes to write everything down and write the pros and the cons and really just meditate and see where God is leading him after he puts all this on paper.
Yeah.
And for me, I have a kind of relationship with the Lord where I talk to him like a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like I see him in things I read. I see him answering to me in people I meet. And I know in my heart what he's trying to tell me. And we will come to each other after we've made big decisions and talk about what we think we should do while we're making big decisions. And we usually have the same answer. And John will say, how did you come up with that? And I'll say, I just knew it's the answer. It's in my heart.
Yeah.
And he doesn't understand me, but you know what? That's the way God speaks to both of us.
Sure.
And it's really nice because our children have had to make big decisions.
Yeah.
And when our son was making one, I remember he came to us and he asked how we pray like that. And he tried John's way. And he came back to us. He said, Dad, that's not me.
Yeah.
He said, I'm a lot more like Mom.
Yeah.
I can't write everything down. So it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It really matters that you are trying to listen to God. And he is going to speak to you if you let him.
Very good. I wanted to touch on something which comes up most frequently when I'm out speaking and we do the Q&A. And that is, what happens when the children don't turn out to meet your expectations? You've tried to raise them in the faith. You've tried to pass along the faith, but they've drifted away, either through indifference or because they have a positive decision to reject Catholicism. Mm-hmm. What do you do there at that point? How do you, on the one hand, you don't want to write your children off, but you don't want to always be beating your head against the wall either.
I mean, thankfully for us, we have been so blessed and so fortunate that has not, please God, been our experience with our own children, but we have many dear friends who did many of the same things we've done over the years with their kids, and only to have their kids either reject or just become indifferent to the faith. And it's a really profound source of suffering for these friends. I mean, our counsel and our experience has been the best thing to do is to continue to love your child, continue to accompany him as best you can, to use Pope Francis's term, as best you can, in love, in prayer and support. When you see them making choices that you know to be are destructive and morally wrong, to speak the truth in love to them, but not to let that necessarily end the relationship, at least not on, you know, it's, think of the father of the prodigal son, rather, who his son was, as he says in the parable, dead, spiritually dead, and yet the father waited and watched and hoped for his son to return. And when his son was a long way off, he saw him and ran to him to embrace him and welcome him back into the family. So, you know, think of Saint Monica, who prayed for Augustine for years and years and years, and he called himself the son of her tears and her prayers because of her great love and her fervent prayer for his conversion. So it's a major challenge, and it's something that a lot of parents struggle with and have to contend with. But you know, it's the virtue of hope that sustains us, and the knowledge that ultimately God loves our children more than we do.
Right.
And God wants our children to be in a relationship with him more than we do.
Yeah. No, that's very well said. We're just about out of time. How do people stay in touch with the work that you're doing?
Actually, I'll let Claire respond because we are not of the millennial generation now, but we're slowly developing some social media presence. Claire has an Instagram account.
Okay, we've got about 15 seconds,
Instagram.
Claire.
Okay, follow me on marriage.4.life.
Marriage4.life. Sounds great. Thanks so much, John. Claire, great talking with you again.
Thank you, Al.
John and Claire Grabowski, Raising Catholic Kids for Their Vocations. We'll have that all that information posted at AveMariaRadio.net in the Cresta Guest Archive.
Ever wonder why social networking is such a popular internet exercise? We humans are hardwired for society. It's in our DNA. The human person needs to live in society, the Catholic Catechism tells us. It is a requirement of man's nature. There is a certain resemblance between the unity of the three divine persons and the fraternity that humans are to establish among themselves in truth and love. As Jesus made clear, love of God is inseparable from love of neighbor. Humanity's vocation, says the Catechism, is to show forth the image of God and be transformed into the image of the Father's only Son, Jesus. It is through mutual service and dialogue with one another that we develop our potential and thus respond to the end to which we are called, God Himself. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's the definition of frustration? Frustration is the difference between the way it is and the way you want it to be. It's hard to change the way it is. The way it is sometimes is other people, life, circumstances. The way you want it to be is in your power to change. You can close the gap between
reality and what you want. The smaller that gap, the less your frustration. It is always easier to change oneself than to change reality. Frustration isn't always what happens out there. It is how we look at what happens out there.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Let me remind you that John and Claire Grabowski's book, available in the online bookstore. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net. That is AveMariaRadio.net. Again, raising Catholic kids for their vocations. We're blessed in a time where more and more committed Catholics who are rich in theology and personal experience are writing for us to help us become leaders of our domestic church, which our families must be strong if the parish is going to be strong. So John and Claire Grabowski's book, Raising Catholic Kids for the Vocations, in our online bookstore, so I'd urge you to get there. Information following up on Raymond Ibrahim's being the subject of a massive smear campaign by CARE. We'll have follow-up information for you again at AveMariaRadio.net in the Cresta Guest Archives. Now, next hour, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas joins us. He has served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he also serves as part of the Old Guard at Arlington National Cemetery, performing military funerals for hundreds of veterans and fallen comrades. He'll join us with a look at this Army unit whose mission is to honor the fallen heroes. It's the most hallowed ground in America's civil religion, sacred duty, a soldier's tour at Arlington National Cemetery. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Well, thank you for joining us. We've got another hour to talk about the things that matter most. How about God's love language? The idea of love languages was made popular by Gary Chapman, but others have picked up on it as well. And there is a lot of insight into understanding the different ways in which we speak and act out love. My guest, Jeanette Flood, has done a marvelous job in a book called 8 Ways of Loving God, revealed by Love Himself. We'll take a look, first of all, at prayer, which, of course, is God's number one love language. But even the question, why should I love God in a world where there's such suffering, in which you have been the object of suffering, and maybe your children? How do you love God in such a world? Loving God means obeying Him. It means apologizing for turning away from Him. There are many ways of loving God that Jeanette will go over with us. Also coming up in this hour, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas will talk to us about sacred duty, a soldier's tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Senator Cotton is also part of the Old Guard there. This is very high-level unit, which is responsible for carrying out the military funerals for hundreds of veterans there, fallen comrades. He's going to join us with an inside look at this particular Army unit, whose mission is to honor fallen heroes on the most hallowed grounds in America. And we certainly know that there is a certain sense of the sacred in laying down one's life for others. And that's why Catholics can look upon military service and military duty as an act of love on behalf of those who are innocent. We are called to protect and defend the innocent. So we're going to talk that over with Senator Cotton. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, June 17th. It's the feast of St. Albert Shmilovsky. Today's news is sponsored by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump's reelection campaign is firing some of its pollsters over leaked polling information. At the White House, NBC News' Hans Nichols says the Trump administration is acknowledging that polls exist.
They're basically saying it's old news, and I think we have to look at the shift in the rhetoric in the last 3 months to figure out where the president is going to try to go from here on to Election Day.
The data show Trump well behind former Vice President Joe Biden in several key states. The polling information that was leaked showed Biden leading Trump by double digits in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Michigan. In 2016, Trump beat Hillary Clinton in all four of those states that proved decisive in his Electoral College victory that put him in the White House. Iran says it will break the internationally agreed limit on its low-enriched uranium stockpiles by the end of the week. In Doha, Qatar, NBC News national security correspondent Courtney Kube says Iran's move is another play in a game of chicken, and the U.S. is trying to counter it.
In this case, it's about diplomacy. They're talking now a lot about building some kind of an international coalition or consensus against Iran.
The country's Atomic Energy Organization says it will increase enrichment levels to 20% in 10 days. A spokesperson for the organization said Europe can rescue the 2015 nuclear deal if the countries that signed it, besides the U.S., find a way to shield Iran from the crippling effect of U.S. economic sanctions. President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal last year and imposed stiff sanctions on the Islamic Republic. And the Supreme Court is giving Virginia Democrats a win in a case involving racial gerrymandering. The High Court said the state's Republican-led House of Delegates didn't have standing to challenge a lower court that some of the state's legislative districts were drawn in a way that puts minorities at a disadvantage. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. I just came across a book that I thought was especially fascinating. It's called Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery, authored by Senator Tom Cotton. He has served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he's also part of the Old Guard, a top-notch unit at Arlington National Cemetery, performing military funerals for hundreds of veterans and fallen comrades. And Sacred Duty takes us inside that unit to understand its mission to honor our fallen heroes on what really is the most hallowed ground in America in light of our, you might call it our national civil religion. And Senator Cotton, it's great to have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Al. It's great to be on with you, and thank you for your interest in Sacred Duty.
Yeah, talk to me about what it's like being a member of the Old Guard. First of all, how did you get that assignment?
Well, as I write in Sacred Duty, the Old Guard is one of the few volunteer-only all-application units in the Army, along with some of our elite special forces. Although, strangely, I didn't apply and I didn't volunteer. that is the ideal or the standard for which I aim, but in my days in the Army, as in every unit, the Old Guard was stretched thin because the Army was too small in those days, 2006, 7, 8.
Okay.
For the task the nation expected of it. But the Old Guard is a priority unit because, as I write in Sacred Duty, every funeral in Arlington National Cemetery is a no-fail, zero-defect mission that they have to have the personnel to complete. Mm-hmm. So the Old Guard, in the end of 2006, when I was still in Iraq, just selected six young lieutenants and captains from the Army personnel records based on all the basic eligibility requirements, which are all pretty high, certain height and weight and got to be Ranger qualified and Airborne qualified as an officer. And then from that, they just chose the six tallest ones. So that's how I ended up there. I'm 6'5", and one of the other six guys was 6'7", and the other four were all 6'3". And we all showed up in the 101st Airborne about 4 to 6 months later.
As I understand it, you were studying law and planning on going into legal practice when 9/11 occurred. That changed your career?
Yeah, so going back a few years, since I served in the Old Guard in 2007 and 2008, I was in law school, my last year in law school, on 9/11. And as I walked out of that classroom and I learned what had happened, and I went to the student commons and watched the two towers fall and saw the mayhem and destruction at the Pentagon, I knew that my life had changed. I didn't want to practice law so much anymore. I wanted to serve our nation and go fight overseas against the people who had knocked down those buildings.
Right.
I did finish school, and I worked for a couple of years to pay off all of my loans and to get my affairs in order, but the desire to join the Army never left. So in late 2004, I signed up on the dotted line and shipped out the basic training in early 2005. And for about 2 years, I was either training at Fort Benning or I was fighting in Iraq with 101st Airborne, and then I came back from there and joined the Old Guard in 2007.
Arlington, we talk about Arlington as hallowed ground in America. And tell us how it established that reputation.
So Arlington National Cemetery seems, if I can borrow from Tocqueville in another setting, to have been destined by some secret design of Providence to be our national cemetery. It was virgin forest and farmland when it was acquired by the adopted son of George Washington in 1778. Specifically so he could move his family back up from the Williamsburg area in the Virginia Tidewater and be closer to his mother, who was widowed at an early age before she remarried George Washington, and be close to George Washington, who had raised him as his own son. Sadly, he died shortly after the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, which won the Revolutionary War for us. He left behind a six-month-old heir, and George and Martha adopted that grandson, raised him as their own child at Mount Vernon for 8 years during the Washington presidency when our capital was in Philadelphia, and then at Mount Vernon again. And his name, George Washington Parke Custis, to give you a sense of how much they esteemed their own father when they named him, when he moved up to Arlington in 1802, first off, it was named Mount Washington at the time before he renamed it Arlington a few years later. He built that big mansion you can still see up on the hills as a kind of homage to Mount Vernon and operated Arlington for much of his life deeply in debt because he used the revenues to acquire George Washington relics and heirlooms and memorabilia, which he threw open to the public as kind of the first public memorial to Washington, so much so that Arlington was known for most of the first half of the 20th century as Washington's treasury.
Wow.
Another young military officer moved in 1831 when his only daughter, Mary Custis, married Robert E. Lee, himself the son of one of George Washington's revolutionary commanders. And they made that their home in the winter times when Lee was not off building forts for 30 years. They lived there probably more than two-thirds of the winters. That really was Robert E. Lee's only home. Huh. And he was offered command of the Union Army in April 1861. Which, of course, he declined and resigned his commission and went to Richmond. And just a few weeks later, on May 24th, 1861, the Union Army crossed the Potomac under cover of night, and they occupied that land. They held it every single day since then. And then 3 years later, they converted it into a graveyard because the Union war dead were filling up almost every cemetery in the capital. And then they converted it to a national cemetery. Strangely, Robert E. Lee's son, to give you a sense of how deep these roots run in Arlington, who himself was named George Washington Custis Lee, he sued the federal government to get that land back, even though several thousand Union war dead were buried there. And he took it all the way to Supreme Court. And in U.S. v. Lee in 1882, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Lee family.
Huh.
So Justice Lee now held title to our national cemetery, but he was magnanimous in victory. He didn't ask to reclaim the land. He simply asked for just compensation. So he received $150,000 from the United States government. He signed a deed of title over to the government, and the man who accepted that deed in his official capacity was the Secretary of War, Robert Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son.
Wow.
So if you think about it, just 18 months after a war that had been so brutal that we killed more Americans by our own hands than in every other war we've ever lost.
Yeah.
The firstborn sons of Robert E. Lee and Abraham Lincoln were able to act in concert to create our national cemetery once and for all. I think that story is part of the reason it's become such sacred ground, such a place of healing and reconciliation and unity for our country.
Yes, that's remarkable. A place of reconciliation, healing, maintenance of the Union. The Civil War dead, were many of them in Arlington?
Not at first, and that was controversial, as eligibility requirements are and remain controversial about Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, they did, in fact, open up Arlington to Civil War veterans as well. Many of those Civil War veterans have headstones that are slightly different from the iconic rounded headstone. They have pointed headstones. But after a couple decades, in part through some political bargaining between the senators and congressmen from the readmitted states from the old Confederacy, they agreed to open the cemetery up to the Confederate war dead. It also was open to all of the war dead from previous wars as well, so some soldiers going back as far as the Revolutionary War were disinterred and reinterred at Arlington. So you can find at Arlington Americans who have fought in every single battle going back to our very first war.
Mm. You know, in the 1960s, patriotism, duty, honor, respect were under attack and remain under attack in certain sectors of American culture and society. Talk to me about how the old guard embodies the meaning of patriotism, duty, honor, and respect. What are the ritual actions that are taking place, the care shown to the dress, the precision of movement? Give us some idea, because it's a highly enacted civic liturgy, it seems to me.
As I write in Sacred Duty, the old guard has a very simple and singular standard for every military honor funeral, and that's perfection. And that's true whether it's a humble private or whether it was President George H.W. Bush last December. It can take up to 2 or 3 months for a new soldier to certify through rigorous training and testing that he's prepared to perform a funeral in Arlington National Cemetery.
Wow.
That's preparing a uniform from scratch using large industrial-sized presses that every old guard company has in its barracks, building medals from scratch using materials you might find at Hobby Lobby or your local hardware store, learning the unique old guard techniques of marching as well as the small unit tasks like folding a flag to crisp triangular perfection in exactly a minute and 55 seconds or making 7 rifles fire as one in the 3-volley salute. The training and testing is rigorous because the mission is so prominent and so sensitive. There are no do-overs in Arlington, and we all knew that for every family, each funeral was a once-in-a-lifetime moment, and it was a lifetime in the making, even if it was the 7th or 8th funeral we performed that day.
Yeah.
And we took that with the utmost seriousness. And I think one reason for that is when you were, if you're the officer in charge of a funeral, you receive that folded flag, you turn and you walk a few steps to the next of kin. Sometimes an elderly widow or widower from a veteran who served in World War II or Korea, maybe an adult child. Unfortunately, sometimes, especially in those days, a young widow and maybe young children and parents as well. But when you take a knee and you present that flag, you say you're presenting it on behalf of the president and the army and behalf of a grateful nation. And that's really the old guard's mission, is to express the gratitude, the respect, and even the love of a grateful nation in that one moment. And that's one reason why the standards are so, so high. And every single soldier that I ever served with or whom I met over the course of my research for this book thought they should be that high.
Who is qualified to be buried at Arlington?
So that changes over time. As, you know, as we discussed earlier, Confederate veterans were not initially, and then they later were. Today, there are many categories. Some of them are pretty small and obscure. For instance, a Supreme Court justice that not many of us would qualify for. But here are the main categories. Of course, anyone who has killed in action overseas today. Anyone who has earned by his or her valor on the battlefield a Silver Star or Medal for Valor in higher precedence than a Silver Star. Third, any person who has received a Purple Heart due to wounds received in combat. And fourth, probably the largest category today, are those who have served honorably and retired with 20 or more years of service. Again, there are many more standards, and there are slightly different standards for in-ground burial or for inurnment in
yes.
one of the columbaria, which are the open-air buildings with thousands of niches for the urns carrying cremated remains. But those are the four main categories today.
Senator, thank you so much for the work that you put into the book and for your service to the country. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest in sacred duty. I appreciate it.
Tom Cotton is Senator from Arkansas. Sacred Duty, a Soldier's Toward Arlington National Cemetery.
How serious is our responsibility to participate in furthering the common good? Very serious. According to the Catholic Catechism, participation is the voluntary and generous engagement of a person in social interchange. This obligation is inherent in the dignity of the human person. Participation calls, first of all, for us to be conscientious in exercising our responsibility in areas where we are directly involved, our families, our children's education, and our work. As far as possible, the Catechism urges, we should take an active role in public life. This leads to the Catechism's conclusion that nations which allow the broadest possible citizen participation are the nations to be lauded. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
The Church tells us children need mothers and fathers, and science is just beginning to reveal how true that is. New brain research in mammals reveals that involved fathers affect an infant's developing brain differently than mothers. For instance, while a mother's attentive presence and affection nourishes the centers of an infant's brain that allow them to bounce back from stress, an attentive and affectionate father's care stimulates the parts of the infant's brain that allow the child to better regulate their tendencies toward aggression. So it turns out moms and dads play critically important but very distinct roles in their children's ability to lead peaceful lives. Once again, the science is clear. The best prescription for well-adjusted kids is both a present and loving mother and father. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tomeo, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
Abortion.
Pornography.
Embryonic stem cell research.
Corporate contributions to Planned Parenthood. Do you invest in companies that are engaged in these practices? The Ave Maria Mutual Funds do not, and their investment portfolios reflect that. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Now, on the Ave Maria Radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic Adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks under the prayer section on the Ave Maria Radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for joining me. I was given a manuscript to read, probably 6 months ago, and I thought it was intriguing because the author took the idea of love languages. You may know that over the last generation, there have been a number of popular books written about our different love languages that we have in helping us understand our relationship with our loved ones, spouses, those who were contemplating dating. And I thought it was interesting to apply this idea of love languages to God. My guest, Jeanette Flood, is a freelance writer, a speaker, spiritual director, who enjoys sharing what the Lord has taught in her life from the hundreds of books on faith that she's read over 27 years working in Catholic publishing. She and her husband have 6 children ranging in age from 6 to 25. And Jeanette, it's good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
8 Ways of Loving God is the name of the book revealed by Love Himself. Let's talk about how you identified 8.
It kind of grew. I began with the one that Jesus expressed most explicitly at the Last Supper. He said, "If you love me, you will obey my commands."
Mm-hmm.
And the beloved disciple repeated that many times in his letters. So I began with that, and I just started thinking about love and human relationships and how much more there is to it, and then reflecting on the life and teachings of Jesus, and it just kind of grew from there.
Yeah. So this is something that these various 8 ways can be identified in the life of Jesus, his earthly life?
Yes, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay. Well, you've divided them up in 3 different parts here. But let me go back to a prior question, which I should have asked.
Sure.
A lot of people today ask a question which I think a generation ago one would have assumed the answer would be yes. It's the question, why should I love God? People always assumed they knew why they should love God because he made them. But that question is being asked today by people who really don't hold the assumption any longer that they have any duty or obligation or relationship with God. So why should I love God?
Yeah, you've picked on something that's very common, and it's not altogether recent. I mean, C.S. Lewis talked about our, 20th century back then,
mm-hmm.
putting God in the dock. You know,
right.
We used to think that God was judging us, but now we're judging God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might come a little bit, it happens more in first world countries where we enjoy so much comfort, most of us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think without our realizing it, kind of a sense of entitlement kind of creeps in. We're just so used to having everything that we want or many things that we need. But we should love God, if we stop and think about it, because everything we have comes from him. I mean, we owe him everything. Every good thing comes from him. And yet, he's not like any of the gods that human beings have created who are distant or uncaring, but he loves us, and he loves us so much that he died for us. He became one of us, which was amazing in itself, but he died for us. And then, as you get to know him, you realize that he is infinitely lovable. Anything that is lovable about anyone else that we love, he has, infinitely more of. So give him a chance, and you'll find out how easy it is to love him.
What do you give to a God who has everything?
The only thing you can give is yourself. He gave you yourself, but he gave you and your life, but he also gave you free will. So you don't have anything to do with your creation. You didn't have any choice in that. But then you mm-hmm. have a choice in what you will do with it and what you will do with your free will. And, just like my children, might take my paper and my, the crayons I bought for them and make me a picture, it's still, you know, they've used the things I've given them, but they've chosen to do that as an act of love for me. And so in the same way, we can take what God has given us and we can use it for ourselves, or we can choose to give it back to him. And the main thing we can give back to him is our love, ourselves.
And love is defined how in the book?
Love is desiring the good of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Thomas Aquinas put it.
Yeah, that's classic definition, right?
Yeah.
And so it's obviously more than a feeling.
Yes, and it's also an action. I quote many times, St. Teresa of Avila also says, love is proved by deeds.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do external things that other people might observe and think, wow, that person's really holy. But if we're not doing it, you know, with love in our hearts or with the right intention, God is not going to be fooled by that. But on the other hand, if we just say, I love God, and we do nothing for him, that's not real love either.
You know, this is very interesting, because oftentimes love is defined in terms of attitude or even desire. Your love, it takes more. It's more than attitude. It has
right.
to be a function of the will.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have to be, I think a lot of life is, I don't want to say proving our love, because that sounds like God doesn't trust us or something, but I think we need to do it for ourselves as much or more for him. We need to be constantly acting on that love, or it will fade.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So let me back to this then. We are called to love God. It's really a function of thanksgiving for our being in the world. And then, of course, we get to know him more intimately. We see him in his Son. We then demonstrate that through our deeds. How is love in this way different than just good works?
I think, you know, in Catholic theology, they talk a lot about, you know, what makes an action good or what makes an action sinful.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it is the action itself, but also the intention mm-hmm. and the freedom that we have are also bound up in that, you know. So our intention is an important part of that as well. And, you know, as I'm talking, I'm losing sense of what you asked.
Yeah, and that is, there are people who will tell you, and they even have a checklist of how many good things
right.
they've done, quote, for God or for neighbor. And yet there's something about it which seems a little dry, a little less than what we think of as love. It seems more mere duty.
Exactly. So if we think of God as a judge and we're trying to please him, or if we think we can earn our way to heaven, then we're going to do good works with a totally different intention and attitude than if we are doing them because we're grateful to him and we think he's wonderful and we want to spend our lives pleasing him
right.
out of love. It's going to be completely different. And then, you know, kind of ticking something off and saying, well, I did this, so now you have to do that. That's not an attitude of love. That's, you know, an employee and an employer.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a master and a servant.
Mm-hmm.
And we are his servants, so we should be doing it anyway. I mean, we have an obligation to do it. But he invites us to be his friends, to be his children, and to do these things out of love.
You write that prayer is God's number one love language. And prayer presupposes trust, though, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I think if you don't trust someone, you're not going to want to spend time with them.
Right, right.
And spending time is, you know, another way of defining prayer, spending mm-hmm. time with God.
What are the obstacles that you've come across, either in your own experience or in discussing this with others, obstacles to trusting God?
I think probably the number one is suffering. and observing suffering in others or in the world in general, we just can't understand how God could allow it. And that was true in my own life as well.
Mm-hmm. How did you work through that then?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll try to keep it short. Shortly after I was married, it became more clear to me. I had a suspicion that I had been molested as a child, but repressed the memory.
Uh-huh.
But I started having flashbacks, and then I went to a movie that included a rape scene. Uh-huh. And I just, you know, had this really intense reaction where I was just, you know, I had to leave the movie, and I was pacing back and forth in the bathroom. I was just filled with rage.
Wow.
This had been not only that it might have happened to me, it did happen to a relative of mine,
mm-hmm.
but also that, you know, just throughout time and throughout cultures, this has been going on, and it just, the injustice of it just bothered me so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked out of that theater, and I just fell into a deep depression. It was really hard, and I was trying to pray about it. I mean, I had a regular prayer time. I didn't really know how to meditate, but I would try to connect with God every day at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting really dry and before this. And it continued to be. I just wasn't getting any consolations, any sense of his love or his presence or his comfort, nothing. And I just was so mad at him for letting this happen to me when I was a child, you know.
Yes.
That I just said, okay, if you're not going to show up, I'm not going to either. But I still believed.
Yep.
And I still kept going to Mass on Sunday, and I'd go to confession occasionally and just cry. But I just kind of felt like, and also I had a small child, and I started thinking, you know, how do I know? There are all kinds of things that could happen to her that I can't stop them from happening.
Yes.
And I can't, you know, before I used to just trust the Lord for everything, and I was starting to think, well, you know, can I really trust him
right.
to take care of my daughter?
Yeah.
It was tough. But then eventually I received the anointing of the sick, and I can continue.
Yeah, hold it there. Would you, Jeanette? I want to come back and pick up on that, because I think this is, I mean, many people going through suffering feel that they shouldn't feel this way, but we'll be right back. Jeanette Flood, 8 Ways of Loving God.
The EWTN home video highlight for May is the story of Father John Sullivan. A Protestant born into a life of privilege, he left everything to follow God's call to become a Catholic priest and serve the poor and afflicted. And the faithful were blessed with countless miracles. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or call 1-800-854-6316.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Why are there so few practicing Catholics in public office? And by practicing, I mean Orthodox, faithful to all the Church's teachings. There are many thousands of good Catholic candidates for school boards, mayor seats, state senate, Congress, governorships, even the presidency. They're out there. Some of them may be listening right now. We need to spend less time complaining about faux Catholics out there and more of our time encouraging the real ones to get in the game. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, number 1915, we read, "As far as possible, citizens should take an active part in public life." Don't get me wrong, public life is not easy. The times are tough. But were they as tough as the first, say, 300 years of the Church? Haven't we as Catholics faced down more fearsome enemies than the ones we face today? I think so too. I'm Patrick Coffin of PatrickCoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Jeanette Flood is with me. 8 Ways of Loving God, the name of the book, revealed by Love Himself. We're looking here at the problem of trusting God when, well, suffering, personal suffering, seeing suffering in the world. How do you trust God? And to what degree can you say to God, look, you expect me to trust you, but look what happened to me as a kid. If I had the power, I wouldn't let my kids go through this, but you let me go through this. So how do I trust you? And go ahead and frame it any way you want there, Jeanette.
Yeah, I was telling about, you know, the resurfacing of a repressed trauma that I had been molested as a child, and was just really angry at the Lord for letting it happen and then not letting me feel his presence or
right.
his comfort.
Right.
And, you know, my husband kept encouraging me to get back to prayer and get back to weekday Mass. I met a priest. I told him, you know, I'm feeling depressed, and he instantly offered me the sacrament of anointing, which was amazing because I had been seeing another priest for a year, and we had dissected everything, and I knew why I felt this way, but I didn't feel any better.
Yeah.
But when
yeah.
after I received the sacrament, I just knew I had turned a corner.
Wow.
And I decided, well, I'll listen to my husband and I'll go. So I went to Mass and I said, but look, you know, we have a toddler and it's really hard to pray. So he said,
yes.
Look, we'll take turns. I'll watch her. And so he took her and I started praying. And there was this scripture verse that I knew the Lord wanted me to think about,
mm-hmm.
but I was too mad to think about it. But it was, whatsoever you do to the least of my brothers, that you do unto me. So I sat down and said, okay, I'm going to think about it. And I just thought, could that be true for me in this case? And part of my anger was that I felt like, I was probably wrong, but I felt like, you know, cancer or something like that I could handle. But being molested seemed such a violation, and there was such a sense of shame with it that it seemed, and I couldn't find any saints who had been raped,
yeah.
you know, or molested.
Yeah.
There is one or two blessed I found later on. So it just seemed like a shameful thing that, you know, this was worse than any other kind of suffering because of the shame in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why I'd been refraining from thinking about this, because to think about Jesus, you know, does this mean that Jesus, the Lord, didn't abandon me? He wasn't, like, just looking at me with a divine shrug and saying, well, you know, you got to have a cross, you know.
Yeah.
But no, he was in me, with me, suffering in me. And I just thought, no, Jesus, this could not happen to Jesus. That would be terrible. That's unthinkable. And part of the reason is that victims are treated and often actually explicitly told that they are objects of shame. They're treated as an object, and they're treated as a disgusting object of shame that brought them on this on themselves. So that's why it was unthinkable that this could happen to Jesus. And I said, no, Jesus cannot be an object of shame. And then it just kind of hit me. I think he took over my imagination, and I could see him there and saying to me, and you're not either. And I just kind of saw myself covered in this tar. And with him being there, it just started to break up and lift off of me and float away. And I wondered, well, where is it going to go? And then I saw a man, and it started landing on the man. And, you know, before I wanted to rip off the face of the perpetrator.
Yes.
I'm a pretty pacifistic person, but I was really feeling violent toward this person. And at that moment, I had pity. I thought, how awful to have that shame on you and to know it actually belongs to you.
Wow.
And what is going to happen to him?
Right.
And
so you would translate. Go ahead.
Previously, I had thought also, you know, the saints, you go to Europe and you see Saint Sebastian, he's got all his arrows in there, and you see another saint holding his head, you know, like their sufferings are their glory in heaven, you know. But I thought, this is not going to be anything glorious. I'm going to want to hide this. But then I realized, if I offer up my sufferings for the perpetrator, that would be glorious. And if he was saved, then that would be something good that God would bring out of this.
Yes.
And he gave me the grace to do it, and I just walked out a different person. And the depression totally left.
Wow.
I forgave God. I forgave the man. I felt totally at peace. And I was struck by the tremendous weight of the freedom that we are given, that God can take anything terrible and evil, even the worst thing that ever happened, the murder of God, and turn it into something good. And
yes.
In his case, the best thing that ever happened. And he gives us that chance, too.
Yes, yes.
He gives us that option, but it's up to us whether or not we're going to do that, whether we're going to say, yes, this was terrible, but with your help, I'll turn it into something good.
Mm.
Or I give you permission to do it.
So would you say that you were able then to transfer that shame and dishonor that you were feeling, and you transferred it to Jesus? Is that what happened?
No, I felt that Jesus was with me, suffering with me and identifying with me, and yet neither of us were actually rendered an object of shame.
So he
but
was...
the man who had done this did own the shame.
Yes, okay.
But that I could forgive him and turn what he had done and all the pain he had given me and turn it into good by offering it up with the sufferings of Jesus for his as a prayer for his salvation.
Yes, yes. So did you realize then that Jesus had been with you during that experience?
Yes, I realized that he had never left me.
Yeah, yeah. That's fascinating. I mean, really, I mean, more than fascinating. It's redemptive. But it just, again, hearing you recite the story itself makes it that much more real. That this isn't just a doctrine that you held. It was an application of truth to your life, and it was effective, incredibly effective. Talking about eight ways of loving God, my guest Jeanette Flood has written what I think is highly illustrative and theologically rich book that will take us much deeper in our devotion to Christ. I want to move on to some of the other ways here that you talk about love languages. Prayer is the number one love language. Loving God means apologizing for turning away from him. I thought this was interesting. That is something that many, I think we all know, we do it. We do turn away from him. But we kind of think to ourselves, well, he knows I'm going to do that. He knows me. He knows I didn't really mean it. And so we don't feel necessarily we should apologize to him for turning away. Talk to me about this.
Well, you know, it was made particularly famous in that movie. I'm forgetting the name of it, but, you know, love means never having to say you're sorry.
Right, right.
And it's just so true, not untrue. And Ryan O'Neal says that in the movie. I don't know if you remember the title, but Love Story. Yeah. And then, actually, also his girlfriend says it as well.
Yeah, Ally McGraw.
But then later on in What's Up, Doc, somebody says that. I think maybe Barbara Streisand says that. And he says, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Same actor. And John Lennon said, you know, no, actually, love means saying sorry every 15 minutes. So, you know, we know this in our own relationships, most of us.
Right.
Most reasonable people know that you need to do that.
Right.
And why should we expect God to be any different? But yes, he is different. He's God. But we're in a relationship with him. He doesn't want to be taken for granted any more than any of us do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I kind of framed it that way because people do not understand confession, as I'm sure you're already aware.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of resistance against it, even among Catholics.
Right.
I mean, confession lines are very short these days.
Mm-hmm.
But if we frame it in that way, I need to apologize to the Lord.
Right. I think many people see it as a mere duty. They don't understand it in relational terms.
Right, right. And people object to talking to a priest, although, you know, he's representing God
right.
for our benefit,
yes.
so that at the end we can hear those words and be comforted by them. I absolve you of your sins. Now go in peace.
Yes.
Now, that's a wonderful thing to hear.
Amen.
And also he's representing the rest of the body of Christ or the rest of humanity whom we have also offended, and he's forgiving us on their behalf.
Right, right.
But the way I put it is, you know, if I did something to a friend and I really hurt her feelings and she wanted me to apologize, you know, in a certain way by giving flowers or something, I would do it, you know. And if God chooses to tell us to go to a priest, well, I'll do it, you know. If he wants me to jump up and down in the mall and write him a sonnet of apology, I do that. Whatever speaks to him, I'll do it.
Right.
You know.
Well, loving God means loving those he loves. That is especially challenging, I think, for those of us who actually have enemies. Once we realize we actually do have enemies, and then we're called to love them, and we're called to love them because they're created by God in his image and likeness. God sent his son for them. They are those for whom Christ died. Give us a little meditation on loving God, meaning loving those he loves.
Well, we all, you know, have heard that God loves us, and we're not surprised, you know, we're not always surprised by that. Some people are. But, you know, we see that we're lovable, and we have to realize that he loves them just as much, and that he doesn't see them the way we do. He sees the goodness in them. He sees the potential greater goodness in them. And we just can't expect to go to heaven and say, oh, hey, you know, forgive me for everything and get rid of all this sin. But, oh, that guy over there, no. He doesn't get to go in even though he's sorry, you know. And we try to put his sin back on him. You know, it's just not fair for one thing. But if Jesus is identifying with me, he's also identifying with that guy over there.
Right.
And he loves him.
Right.
So we need to love him, too. And I honestly think that among all the things that Jesus asked us to do, forgiving others and loving our enemies are among the hardest.
Yeah.
The very hardest.
It's quite disconcerting. I mean, at an emotional level, I think it's disconcerting. Once we realize that we really don't like these people, and yet we are called to love them.
Well, two things have helped me. One is to realize that love does not have to include warm, fuzzy feelings.
Right.
So we can recognize that this person has done us wrong and pray for them. And every time, and forgiving is an act of the will. So if we feel, you know, hard feelings coming up again, I just, with my will, I choose to forgive that person, yeah. And I offer these feelings for that person.
Yeah.
And also to recognize I'm a sinner and I've done bad things.
Yeah, and you've been forgiven. Yeah. Jeanette, thanks so much. Great talking with you again, and we'll talk in the future.
Okay, thank you so much, Al. What an honor. Appreciate it.
Jeanette Flood's book is called 8 Ways of Loving God. I love the book. 8 Ways of Loving God, revealed by Love Himself.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the 7 letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, like more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy, was I want to give as much as I can, my whole self, to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Fascinating book. This is one of those books that we put on the program because, in all honesty, most of us really don't know anything about the Old Guard or the extraordinary liturgy, I call it a liturgy, of what the soldiers go through as they conduct these, up to 20 of these funerals a day. So you've got to be really sharp. Anyways, it's available in the online bookstore. Again, Sacred Duty by Senator Tom Cotton, a book we should be familiar with. It's an important part of American history. And also, of course, we can talk about God's love languages with Jeanette Flood. That's available for you as well. 8 Ways of Loving God by Jeanette Flood, available in the online bookstore. So head on over there, and you can follow up on any of the conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net and check out the Cresta Guest Archives. Thank you. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.